ఆహా ప్రభు నిత్యానంద ప్రేమానంద సుఖీ కృపావలోకన కరో ఆమి బరు దుఃఖీ దయా కరో సీతాపతి అద్వైత గోసాయ తవ కృపా వలే పాయ చైతన్య నితాయ ఆహా స్వరూప సనాతన రూప రఘునాథ బట్ట యుగ శ్రీ జీవ ప్రభు లోకనాథ దయా కరో శ్రీ ఆచార్య ప్రభు శ్రీనివాస్ రామచంద్ర సంగమగే నరోత్తమ దాస శ్రీకృష్ణ చైతన్య ప్రభు దయా కరు మోరే తోమా బినకే దయాలు జగత సంసారే హరే కృష్ణ 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 హరే 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 రామ హరే రామ 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 హరే హరే కృష్ణ 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 హరే 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 రామ 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 హరే భగవతే వాసుదేవాయ వి ఆర్ రీడింగ్ ఫ్రమ్ ది 10th కాంటో ఆఫ్ ది శ్రీమద్ భాగవతం చాప్టర్ 25 ది చాప్టర్ ఇస్ ఎంటైటిల్డ్ కృష్ణ లివ్స్ గోవర్ధన్ హిల్ టెక్స్ట్ 1 and 2 శ్రీ శుక ఉవాచ ఇంద్రస్తథాత్మన పూజాం విఘ్నాయ విహతాం నృప గోపేభ్య కృష్ణనాథేభ్యో నందాదిభ్యశ్చుకోపః Shishuka Uvacha. Ancient and purport by His Divine Grace, Srila A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. Translation. Shukadev Goswami said, "My dear King Parikshit, when Indra understood that his sacrifice had been put aside, he became furious with Nand Maharaj and the other cowherd men who were accepting Krishna as their Lord." Purport. At the very beginning of this chapter, Shukadev Goswami reveals the foolishness of Indra and the absurdity of his anger. Indra was frustrated because the residents of Vrindavan accepted Sri Krishna as their Lord. But the simple fact is that Sri Krishna is the Lord, not only of the residents of Vrindavan, but of all that exists, including Indra himself. Thus, Indra's petulant reaction was ridiculous. As the common saying goes, pride goes before a fall. Text 2. Ganam samvartakam nama meghanam chantaharinam Indra prachodayat kruddho vakyam chahesha maniyatotkuto. Translation. Angry Indra sent forth the clouds of universal destruction, known as samvartaka. Imagining himself the supreme controller, he spoke as follows. Purport. The word Ishamani here is very significant. Indra arrogantly considered himself to be the Lord, and thus he exhibited the typical attitude of a conditioned soul. Many thinkers in the 20th century have noted the exaggerated sense of individual prestige characteristic of our culture. Indeed, writers have even coined the phrase, the me generation. Everyone in this world is more or less guilty of the syndrome called Ishamana, or proudly considering oneself the Lord. So in this story of King Indra forgetting his real role, Srila Prabhupada in the purport quite astonishingly has, though this he translated his Bhagavatam more than 35 years ago, he uses the word the me generation. He says that many thinkers in the 20th century have noted the exaggerated sense of individual prestige, the characteristic of our culture. Now, if you look at today's state, it is even more apparent that what Prabhupada has said 35 years ago is more obvious now than ever before. So the basic cause of all bondage is the feeling, which is very prevalent among all of us, that I am the doer, I am the controller, you know, I am the enjoyer. It is me who is the center of all our activities. And that's the sole purpose, the first and last purpose. And therefore, because of this and forgetting that actually Krishna is the enjoyer, the root of all the problems begin. If you see, there's crime, terrorism, hatred, envy, all these which are so prevalent today in the world is ultimately coming from this mentality. That I am the doer and I am the enjoyer. That means acting on our false identification of we being the enjoyer. This is really called demoniac mentality. And if you use the word demoniac to describe this mentality, we normally we associate demon with a kind of concept we have, like a 10-headed monster, like Ravan, who would look very ferocious, maybe several hundred feet tall, very ugly. In other words, it gives us a feeling that it is not someone who is in this world, and therefore it is a different world and a different character. But in a very revealing article, very wonderful article written by His Holiness Jayadvait Maharaj many, many years ago in the Back to Godhead, called Who is a Demon? He says that actually, very simply, that as per the Shastras, demons are persons who are not devotees of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Demons are envious of those who are envious of the Lord and His devotees. That's it. Very simple. So by that broad definition, the demons could be among us. It could be us. It could be anybody. They could be well-dressed, soft-spoken, intellectual, with intellectual degrees, brilliant. Could be with PhDs. So it is not really the external fact that matters, but basically the actions and the words which would really convey whether who is a demon. So this external decoration is not of any consequence, and in today's world it is not just individuals but even governments, because ultimately the governments are formed only of the collection of people. So many governments actually ban the activities of spiritual nature under the garb of secularism. So many governments even ban photos of the god and demigods in offices. They do believe that there should be photos of the CM. We also believe the photo should be of CM, which means Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. But they believe it should be the chief minister. And so actually the Bhagavatam says that our scriptures say that today's, that in the demons also replace God by their own worship. And we see this, that by these characteristics, that actually it is this mentality that there is no vague concept of some controller, but it is us who are controlling and maybe directly or indirectly giving that impression that you should worship us. In fact, in some countries, Srila Prabhupada writes that in the 70s and 80s, when communism was at its peak in Russia, the communists, because they don't believe in God, they actually wanted to break the mentality of this religion and the basic feeling that any simple person in any part of the world, a natural feeling that, yes, there is a superpower and there is somebody who controls this. So to break that, they would go to the villages and make a propaganda, especially in Russia, because there were more those who were believers, they were Christians. So not many used to go to the church, but those who would go, then the communists would tell them that when they come out of the church, they said, and they would pray that, oh God, Lord, give us the daily bread. So then they would say, so did the Lord give you any bread? I said, no. So okay, come here. Then they would open the truckloads, they keep the bread there, and they say, take the bread. Then they would ask, who's better, we or God? So they say, you are better. These were simple people. So this was how actually they were trying to directly also do it. So this mentality of controlling and wanting everything for ourselves is very prevalent. The only difference is that the earlier demons were, of course, on a much more powerful basis. The like Kansa and Hiranyakashipu and others, Ravan they would fight with bows and arrows, and now the modern day demons and the impersonal philosophers, they fight the Lord with their arguments. That's the only difference. But what we need to remember is that all 8.4 million species, right up to the level of Indra, are infected by this mentality to some degree or the other, that we are the controllers. And because Indra was so much taken up by this, that's why in these two verses that we've seen, where he brings in the Samvartaka cloud, he acts actually as a spoiled child. When we say somebody is spoiled, we generally say that the person is acting as if he gets frustrated. Usually we associate it with a child, that this child is a spoiled child. What is the mentality of a spoiled person? It's a person who has been accustomed to getting everything its own way. And then when it does not get, then it becomes extremely frustrated. So in fact, any parent who is that way giving everything to the child is doing a great disservice, because it is creating a situation whereby the child would become very miserable when he or she would grow up. Because the frustration and disappointment comes when we don't get what we want. And the fact is that we don't get always what we want. And therefore this mentality comes. So then we would throw tantrums and the anger would come. And then it becomes so strong that to the extent that we may want to hurt the other person. In this case here, Indra is so much caught up with that mentality that he wants to destroy everybody in Vrindavan. And he was infinitely more powerful, so he was doing it to his full capacity. Today, because in Kali Yuga, the power is so limited, but even then, the mentality is that we get so inflicted that we would want to break the other person's feelings or hurt the other person's feelings. Because we become intolerant of inconveniences. We cannot stand the fact that what we expected didn't happen. If you trace this mentality, then so many aspects that are happening in the world can be understood. That because gradually when people in different parts, let's say in the Western world, they have become so much more materially advanced that they have got used to a certain standard of life, a certain way of living. And now for them to preserve that is paramount. For instance, when there is a talk that the root of much of the material gadgets and products ultimately comes from the... In fact, all things ultimately come from the earth, whether it is minerals, metals, and oil, for instance, is the most critical. So it is common knowledge, it's a common feeling, even among impartial American economists who are not known to kind of take a fanatical stand, that this last 2-3 years of intervention in the Middle East from the US has been primarily, it was more a calculated issue about controlling the economic assets, because there is worry that oil will run out, and their main supplier, that is Saudi Arabia, is also now, there is a lot of turbulence there at the low levels, because the Muslims are getting very upset with the rulers of Saudi Arabia who are controlled by the US. So if the Saudi Arabians, who are supplying much of the oil to the US, if they have a problem, then what happens to the US? So the US here, in this same mentality of feeling spoiled, is actually wanting to get what it thinks it deserves. And in the last 20, 30 years, the way things have happened, there is no other alternative system of economic governance than what the U.S. has demonstrates, the Western model of capitalist and independent individual proprietorship and progress. And therefore, to preserve that and to enhance that, not only they will do anything to keep that control, but also they would also see that very, very surreptitiously and subconsciously they would break the resistance to that kind of thinking in other parts. So many innocent people in parts of the world are getting caught in that. So here, this kind of consciousness is highly egocentric and self-centered. This consciousness that, what is in it for me? And if I don't get it, I will do anything to achieve that and to cause pain. And actually, this is contrary to the natural the nature of the soul. The soul is not by nature. The soul is pure. It is part of Krishna. But because it is, there's a artificial covering, or there is a external covering of the false ego, which is so predominant that it gives the color of as if the that is. So that means Krishna consciousness is really when we help to remove the covering of the false ego, just so that the inner vision and the perception of the soul comes through. So till that time, if we act, when we act on the basis of a false ego, then like we have seen in this case, when we act as if we are spoiled, then all our activities are guided by whatever is conducive to our sense gratification. That means we will become very friendly, loving, merciful, kind to people if that helps us to enhance our sense gratification. And when we don't get that, then we are even willing to destroy, or at least we will cut out a relationship, and then we lose interest in that. Once when Srila Prabhupada had gone to Mexico in the early 1970s, so His Holiness Hridayanand Goswami Maharaj, at that time he was a brahmachari, and he was, since he is fluent in Spanish, so he was actually the translator. Though he's American born, but he had learned Spanish just as a service. So he was translating, and as was the practice, they would try to get many prominent citizens to come and meet Srila Prabhupada. So they had brought Miss Mexico to meet Srila Prabhupada. You know, Miss Mexico, like you have Miss India, Miss Universe, Miss World, Miss America. So she was a prominent personality. And as is the nature of such people, you know, they are extremely well trained. They are also selected, apart from their physical looks, but also their ability to talk nicely, how they should, you know, their manners and how they respond. So it is a training that they all go through. They practice for that. So in the same way, when she met Prabhupada, then she said all the nice things, you know, dazzling smile, fluttering eyelids, you know, saying, you know, I like your class very much, and I'd like to come again. So Srila Prabhupada was not taken by that. So he closed his eyes, he just asked her, why do you want to come back? She was not used to such a question. Nobody had ever asked her. So she was kind of struggling for words. And he said, have you read any of my books? She said, no. He said, then why do you want to come back? He was not trying to humiliate her, but he was very blunt and straightforward. He said, why do you want to come back? And it was obvious that, so obviously she never came back. But so this, Prabhupada was, as a guru, as a teacher who, if we really want to slowly get rid of that false ego, we have to associate with those kind of personalities who can help us to shed this false ego and take us to the real ego. But so here we see that the willingness to destroy is so strong that one more area, if you see, is again in marriages, that when people go for divorces, for instance, again, the same thing, that when they are talking so nicely with each other, they're in love and they feel so affectionate to one another, and then sometime later they want to divorce. And in America, 60 to 70% of marriages end up in divorces. In India also, it's catching up so fast. So what it actually means is that when one person feels that the other person is not now somehow accepting the way I want to live, or is not, I don't get my sense gratification, whether bodily or whether emotionally, in whatever way. If I don't feel comfortable, fine, I should leave. And then the divorce courts are actually the most painful. It is the most gruesome, because, you know, they can really rip each other apart. It is if you, you probably, many of you may have known family members and others who may have gone through it, but it's extremely hurtful and very, very difficult because all the hidden secrets, so-called secrets, everything comes out and the effort is only to break that person out of just to get what you want. And the lawyers are very adept at making sure that they bring up all that in the surface. So ultimately it becomes a very painful thing. So this goes contrary again to our nature, the nature of the soul being to be selfless. And therefore we don't get any pleasure when we're doing it entirely on, when we're building relationships on the basis of some material gains. When we actually do it out of any aspect of selflessness where we don't have a direct personal motive, then we actually feel happier. Some years ago, His Holiness Radhanath Maharaj was recounting that he had met one of the top bhajan singers of India, and they happened to meet, and this bhajan singer was telling, when they started talking, and he has been sympathetic to ISKCON, he has come for many programs, for Janmashtami and other programs. So he was recounting to, he was telling Radhanath Maharaj that, you know, whenever I come for these charitable programs for ISKCON or for any other such causes, and I don't charge anything, when I just sing for any cause, I really feel actually so much happier. And he was trying to ask Maharaj, so what is the reason? I feel so much happier, I feel as emotionally closer to Krishna. And then when I go for these paid programs, when I sing bhajans, but when I'm given the some amount, I don't feel that, I just don't have any feelings. So in fact, Maharaj had explained the same point at that time, what we are discussing now, that the nature of the soul is to be selfless and to try to help others, not just put ourselves in the front. So when Krishna says that I am the enjoyer, and if we are opposing that in any way, or if we don't accept that really in our hearts, then basically we are all tiny Indras in our own small capacity, that we would be wanting to have our own honor, we want our own recognition, we want some prestige, we want people to love us, and we, whatever we do is to induce others to recognize us, to give us a good feeling. We feel lost if we are not actually brought to a certain level. Even if it is with the people whom we know intimately, what to speak of those whom we may not know, and when we start cultivating relationships. So there is a very beautiful analogy that is given in the Shastras to describe this false ego and the soul relationship via the example of the cloud, how the cloud covers the sun and the moon. You know, sometimes, especially in the monsoons, we are not able to see the sun in the daytime and the moon in the nighttime. And we would say that it's we can't see the sun or the moon because the clouds are covering it. But actually, even the fact, we cannot see the clouds unless the sunshine comes through or unless the moonshine comes through. So even if you are not seeing the sun into our vision, but when we see the clouds, that is actually the sunshine which is allowing us to see the sun. So the source of the vision is actually the sun or the moon, even though it may not be temporarily there in our vision. So same way, the soul is the source of all consciousness, and the soul is actually, it gives the perception also, or the vision, by which even to the false ego, the perception and vision comes from the soul. But because it is temporarily covered, so we are only acting and looking and seeing on the basis of the false ego. Well, actually, so what we really need to do, what the Shastras tell us, what all the steps for Krishna consciousness are aimed at gradually peeling away, removing this false ego. So this false ego or this false pride is the basis of all other problems like lust, anger, greed, envy, illusion. Because this is the real principle that actually brings us to the material world. So we really need to, Krishna consciousness actually tries to bring us to the platform of the real ego. It is not that we don't have an ego. We all have an ego. But the real ego is that we are part and parcel of Krishna. We are His eternal servants and will always remain so. And we are actually by nature, because we are part of Him, by nature the soul is not only pure and uncontaminated, but it is blissful, Sachidanand. So the quest for that, to try to find that, is our goal. And therefore, there is a certain approach in life, certain process of Krishna consciousness that we need to take. That is why Chaitanya Mahaprabhu kept on stressing the most important shloka, Trinarapi Swani Chena Tarorapi Sahishtunam Amanina Manadena Kirtanya Sadahari, that we should be humbler than a blade of grass, be more tolerant than a tree. Why? Because only in that way, only in that way of life, we can actually go to make progress, to come nearer to Krishna. Krishna would not accept us, we would not be able to reach Him unless we humble ourselves and go to Him. And if it's very interesting, if you see Srila Prabhupada's dealings, that he was, there are stories and stories and stories about Srila Prabhupada. We've heard about his compassion, how he dealt with people. It is apparent, very clear, you know, he never ever rejected anyone on the basis of if somebody had a problem, somebody could not control his senses. We never hear of that. He never told that, remove this person. Often people would, sometimes devotees would complain to him that, you know, this person is not chanting his rounds properly, not chanting 16 rounds, is not doing this, this service is not being done properly, or he's not following this vow. And Prabhupada would never say that, remove him. Prabhupada would say that, okay, we'll look into it. Or he would say that, you know, he needs some help, or he's too stressed, he's got too many services. So basically, it was a very compassionate approach. He would also tolerate many mistakes. He was there to learn. There was never a day when he wouldn't be having to correct dozens and dozens of such mistakes. Once there was a fire sacrifice being conducted by one of his disciples. And he was sitting there, and one of his godbrothers was also there. So his godbrother leaned across and told Prabhupada that, Bhaktivedanta Swami, your disciples are doing it all wrong. So Prabhupada very calmly, you know, sat back and he looked at him and he said, it's all right, they're learning. You know, he would defend them so strongly. So whenever anybody is making genuine mistakes, or whether they they made even gross mistakes on the basis of not controlling their senses, he was very, very compassionate. But he never tolerated any aspect of, you know, this false pride or this independence or the independent nature. A very interesting illustration of this is that there was one of the earliest disciples of Srila Prabhupada. His name was Rayaram Prabhu. Rayaram Prabhu was, he had actually joined, he was among the first five devotees ever to have joined Srila Prabhupada. He joined even before Satswarup Maharaj in 1966, early 67 in New York. And he had read all Prabhupada's books. And he was terrifyingly good in answering questions. He just smashed any questions from any of these hippies and so on. He had absolutely... He was the most learned, in fact. They considered him to be most knowledgeable, one of the most knowledgeable in the Shastras, even in within those 2-3 years. And then he left in end of 1968, early 69. Just abruptly he left. And then again he resurfaced. He came back in 1971. When he came back in 71, the devotees were ecstatic, very happy, because to see some devotee come back, it's a wonderful feeling also. At that time, Srila Prabhupada was not in New York. He was outside America. So when Rayaram Prabhu came, he wrote to Srila Prabhupada. Then he said that, I would like to come back. And he was very politely inquired about Srila Prabhupada, his health and other things. And Srila Prabhupada wrote back. Just see, Prabhupada had not even seen him after he came back. And you can see, if Prabhupada is such a compassionate nature, you know, he would be even more eager than anyone else. You know, devotees recollect that he used to cry if a devotee would leave, you know, because he just felt so much compassion. Why is this person not following? So when Raya Prabhu's letter came, the Prabhupada wrote back saying that it's very nice that you want to join. We are very happy to have you also. But, you know, you have to follow the procedure like all other devotees, all other disciples. You know, attend Mangal Arati, get up early, follow the regular principles, just like any other devotees in the temple, do all the services. He somehow detected and sensed that Rayaram Prabhu was, you know, feeling that he's kind of coming back with, because he was in a special category, so he would come back in a certain position, and there would be certain privileges for him, and Prabhupada detected it, and he wrote and he just nipped it in the bud, saying that, but this you have to follow because it is not good. He clearly mentioned that it is not good if it's the example that you set, if you were to be, if you have some independence, therefore you should follow all this. And then Rayaram Prabhu went away, never came back, nobody saw him. So this is how Srila Prabhupada trained his disciples, and he was giving them, those who followed him, those who tried to understand his mood, could see, and his disciples are also doing the same way, that mistakes will be made. Our natures are to constantly make mistakes. We will try to learn. But if the motive is to be, to have our separate independence, to assert ourselves, to show our control, our pride, then it is such a subtle problem, and therefore it becomes so big. Sometimes the gross problems are easier to address, though they may look very big, and they are big, of course, they have problems of its own, but at least they're easy to, you can recognize that this is a problem. But the subtle problems are almost non-existent, and in such a case, like we saw, even devotees never understood. It was Srila Prabhupada, because he is seeing through the eyes of Krishna and the parampara, and so he could understand that. So our whole objective is to bring the reawaken our real pride. And devotees are not without pride. Devotees are, they are very proud of, say we are very proud of this temple, we are very proud of the deities, Radha Gopinathji, we are very proud of Srila Prabhupada, we are very proud of the acharyas. When we hear the stories, we feel that a sense of belonging, that we are nobody, but we have got a chance, we are so grateful. So that pride, when it is not for us, when it is for the ones who really deserve that, it is in the awakening our consciousness and actually helping us to understand our real position, the constitutional position. But when we substitute, put ourselves in place of those who deserve, then the real problems come, because then gradually, directly or indirectly, then we are we have become the Lord and the controller and all the mentality that we talked about. So, so a Vaishnav is one who would always want to glorify the Guru, he would glorify the Krishna and the Parampara. And there is a story about one devotee called Atma Tattva Prabhu, again Srila Prabhupada's disciple. And he had joined ISKCON, but he had not taken initiation from Srila Prabhupada. And His Holiness Loknath Maharaj had come up to him and said that, shall I recommend your name for initiation? So there was some hesitation. He said, no, I don't want to. I want to wait. He didn't explain why, but he couldn't get himself. He had some hesitation in taking initiation. And the very next day, by coincidence, he attended the morning Guru Puja, and Srila Prabhupada was there, and Prabhupada was sitting on the Vyasasana. And when the Guru Puja was being sung, all the devotees were gathered there, and they were singing to glorify Srila Prabhupada, and they were singing to him. And he was very astonished to see that Prabhupada was also immersed in singing the same Guru Puja. So he said, how is it that he is singing for himself? Why is he glorifying himself? So he went to Loknath Maharaj and said, I'm totally confused. Why is he singing? We are singing to him. So then Loknath Swami explained to him that actually he's singing to his Guru Maharaj. And immediately, at once, in a flash, the whole picture became clear, that the whole aspect of parampara and that whatever worship is given to the guru as a via media, he just sends it back to his guru and so on, back to Krishna. And they never keep anything for themselves. And then immediately told Loknath Maharaj that I would want to take initiation. So when he asked him why, he said, no, all my confusions are clear. So just by being near a pure devotee, by seeing his example, hearing and listening from others also, and reading about, we get the clarity. This also, the false ego is so tricky that, you know, on one hand it makes us want to take credit that I have done this, I have done that. But the problem is that Maya, the illusion, is also plays its own tricks. So the frustration is even more, because in most cases, when we want this to be recognized, then especially as aspiring disciples or devotees, we find that the we don't satisfy anyone, because if you have this mentality, then devotees, Vaishnavas, don't appreciate it. First of all, they are not impressed by the glamour, glitter, the intellect, the money. It doesn't impress them. So you don't get that credit. And on the other hand, the materialists, they become envious if you talk about yourself, saying, I have done this, I have done that. So by talking about that, by glorifying oneself or projecting oneself, we actually end up not even getting what we want, which is even more frustrating. But actually, that's Krishna's way of nudging us towards the reality that this real happiness will come only if we understand what is our position, and the glory is for somebody else, and that's Krishna. But still we can't give it up, this very strong desire of wanting this glory for ourselves or being recognized. It's an addiction. It's a very strong feeling, that craving. And it keeps coming up at different times. And it makes our activities, means it becomes the basis of our activities oftentimes. And there are reasons. The primary reason is that because we are insecure. We are insecure because we have not really got the proper, the taste of glorifying Krishna and his devotees. When you start glorifying Krishna and his devotees and appreciating that gradually, then immediately this desire to glorify ourselves starts going down. And also, the other reason is that it is also, to enhance your image, is also very attractive and very lucrative in today's world, because it projects. You see, those who are to cultivate your image, especially if you have some success and something to project, it becomes very, very profitable. It would be, for the gullible, innocent people like us, we read newspapers, or we see, we hear, and we just, we start imagining various things. But the reality is very different. For instance, in almost all cases, when you find somebody has been invited to open a shop, some celebrity is opening a shop, some celebrities, whoever, whether it is a politician, whether it is a film star or a sportsman or whatever, there is a certain fee for it. And that fee can range to just make an appearance. It could be 10 lakhs, it could be 50 lakhs. Nowadays, for the big weddings also, you hear sometimes that people spend 50 crores and 100 crores for a marriage, one wonders that where does the money go? But generally they may have 5 or 6 programs before the wedding, and they may call a very big film star. A really big film star would, just to come in the evening, would charge 50 lakhs up to a crore for one night. Even many times they call these big names to just mingle with the crowd. You know, if they want to enhance their prestige, that they want that, you've called 20,000 people or 10,000 people, and you want, recognized people or famous people to mingle around, there's a fee. You have to pay for it. So everything is so cut and dried and so commercial. But it becomes so financially attractive to enhance your image that you actually have to start polishing it and thinking only about that, what stories must come in the newspapers and to the people you want them to know, how you should put it. It's a completely different industry, which is one of the most attractive, financial attractive industries, where the image enhancement, they call it in very euphemistic words. They wouldn't call it so bluntly, but primarily it means that it is really to... So it actually only increases our desire, because then those people who get impressed by it, and then they have something to contribute, then they will also want to follow in those footsteps. So everything is done with the idea of giving an impression or an image of what we want to show rather than what we are. And then life is going on. Life is going on for us. Every day goes by, every week goes by, we are growing older, and we are going to miss this opportunity. So that is why an intelligent person is one who understands and tries to keep himself away from this. So therefore, Queen Kunti's prayers, when she prays to the Lord, which are very wonderful, and when she says that, my Lord, only those who are materially exhausted can come easily to you. That means if those who have a lot of wealth, prestige, good looks, intellect, it is very, very difficult for them to approach you. So what does she mean by materially exhausted? She means that those who are impoverished in means those who actually feel that nothing belongs to them. So in that definition, even a rich person, a king, many of the great kings in the past would be also what she calls Tvam Akinchana Gocharam. Like King Prataparudra, for instance, was at the same time as Rupa and Sanatan Goswami and the six Goswamis of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's foremost disciples. So Rupa and Sanatan Goswami had given up everything and they were living a mendicant's life. So they were also Tvam Akinchana Gocharam. And also King Prataparudra, who was the king of Orissa, he was also Tvam Akinchana Gocharam, because he really believed and acted in his life as if nothing belonged to him and everything belonged to Krishna. So whatever position they are put in is immaterial. It is really the attitude in which they live their life. And that is why we want to follow these the examples of these people. But then we have this, when we hear this, that good looks or wealth, intelligence, prestige, etc. These are, one would question that these are okay. These are also given by Krishna. So why would we want to throw it away? So we don't throw it away. But we understand that it is coming from Krishna, and they are all, they have a value only if we attach it to Krishna. It's like we're having many, many zeros. These attributes are like zeros, and they will have no value as zeros. If you have one zero, if you have 100 zeros, there's no value. But if you add one to it, then immediately whether you have one zero or five zeros or 10 zeros definitely has a value. So if it's come from Krishna, then using it for Krishna's purposes are extremely very attractive and very inspiring to others also. So in this connection, when we look at today's environment, it will be very interested to hear that, in fact, you would also be observing that, in the business world, the most successful companies are the ones who attract the best talent. And naturally, if a company is very, very successful, they will want to advertise and project also, and their efficiency and their competence. So that, and then they have a very strong training program and people go to them. So, in fact, the best and the brightest, the people who have been blessed with a lot of intellect, are all flocking to such companies. And to what extent companies would go to keep these people? And then slowly we become so much overawed by this environment that gradually we start feeling that this is the real world, and this is what I want to be like. For instance, the one of probably the most famous company in India, or the company which is most respected in business terms, is a company called Infosys. And they have a training center in Mysore, which is which is quite amazing. Our training center is where, because they recruit, I believe, 10 to 15,000 people every year, and that to extremely bright people. So when they have to go through the training center, they really want to make an impression at that time to the people that this is where your future should be, because there is a lot of competition to get the best talent. So this is just an idea of what modern education, when we are asked to really give the to study hard and then we want to make our career or a future. So in this training campus, they have a gym, they have an aerobics room, they have a badminton court, they have a bowling alley, they have a cricket ground, a football ground, a basketball court, a swimming pool, billiards, pool and snooker, squash, table tennis, volleyball, yoga room. And if you do feel stressed, then you can go get a massage in the saloon, or you can go to the multiplex theater. So basically, even a five-star or a seven-star hotel wouldn't have this kind of facility. So the point is not that why it has. What we need to understand is to what extent, you can imagine if somebody, we have to recognize the reality today that most intelligent people, among the more intelligent people, are picked up when they go there. And when these facilities are there, then the tendency would be to feel that instead of worshipping the Radha Gopinath Murthy, we would be worshipping Narayan Murthy. We would feel that we would just substitute that this is what we really need to look at. So for us to understand that, yes, what we can do in an occupation is one thing, but the reality is that there is something superior and something greater, someone who can control the world, and our life is short, is ticking by, and we need to do it, it becomes more difficult. So when we talk of modern education or intelligence, looks, all these attributes, we have to take the guidance from superiors. Another case in point is, in the last few weeks, you may have read, in fact, just 2 days ago, they said that the Forbes magazine has published the most 100 most powerful women in the world. And there is one Indian who is actually rated even more powerful than Sonia Gandhi. Sonia Gandhi is number 13 on the list. And number 4 on the list of all the women in the world is a young lady. She's in her 40s. She is, from 1st of October, she's becoming the chief executive of worldwide of Pepsi. Very, very intelligent, extremely hardworking. Her name is Indira Nooyi. And she's from Tamil Nadu. She's in the recent past, in the last few weeks, when she has been giving interviews and her profile has come, she said that being a woman and also being an Indian and in the business world, she's had to work twice or thrice as hard as anyone else. So she's, of course, extremely smart. But now, again, this is something where we have seen that someone who's successful, who's tremendously effective, she works 14 hours a day, 7 days a week, 7 in the morning to 9 in the night. She has a family. She manages it well. She has 14 hours means, you can imagine, to reach the office at 7, to leave at 9. And when she goes home, she has stacks and stacks of paper, which she finishes in the night. And this is one of the famous statements she made, that when her boss, before she became chief, the present chief executive, who's retiring on 1st October, when she said that this is the kind of response they have with each other, that if she would receive an email at 4 o'clock in the morning, her answer would go back at 4:01, within a minute. Last year she earned 155 crores, her salary. Now, what really we can see is that if today's world, today's corporations, institutions, they're designed to make it such that as they have a cradle to grave, they call it cradle to grave facility. That means from the time you're born to the time you go, there is the training, there is, and you get completely sucked into it. You are in a, such a world that you have to produce, and this is all if you are extremely productive. If you stop being productive, you are out. I know personally of several cases. I mean, one person was earning more than a crore a year. And he was head of one of the banks, international banks, he was there. And he had spent more than 10 years, very successful. But one Friday morning, he got a call and said that by that evening, he has to vacate and leave. 10 years of service and he's out. So there is no personal touch. There is no, it is only, as we saw earlier, that the relationship and the is really to the extent that it, you are productive or you are effective. So we have to, we are in this world. Many of us are working outside, but we need to be aware of the realities. We need to combine it. So when we need to question that, when we have our own ambitions, we have our own goals, to what extent we are we compromising our spiritual goals? To what extent are we letting go of that? And how we can combine the two? So if it means that sometimes I may be letting go of or if there's a conflict and if I have to make a choice, one has to take cognizance of that. One would not just give it up. Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj actually, when he talked about these four attributes, the high birth, intelligence, good looks and wealth, he said that they are like a gold crown on the head of a person who's drowning. So when a person is drowning, then the crown is actually making the person drown faster. So it has value. It is not that it has no value, but it is, so just like if our consciousness is poor, if we have the wrong consciousness, then we are like a drowning person. So in that consciousness, if we enhance our attributes without changing our consciousness, then actually we are going to sink faster and into that world of which will really lead us to spiritual destruction. We also need to know that the false ego is extremely, extremely subtle. So when we try to analyze ourselves, we are not only bewildered, but also actually tricked. Because of the eight elements, the five gross and three subtle elements, earth, water, air, fire, ether, and mind, intelligence, and false ego, in that order of gross to subtleness, the earth is the most gross, then water is less gross, fire is even less, and it becomes more subtle. Then mind is more subtle, the intelligence is even more, and the subtlest of them is the false ego. So since it is even more subtle than the false ego, than the intelligence, we cannot actually see it by our intelligence, or we cannot try to perceive it through our intelligence. We can only see the symptoms. Just like you have a fever, then you cannot actually see the fever, but you can track it by the symptoms, that the person is not well because of these symptoms. In the same way, we can perceive the symptoms, and these symptoms are our actions and our words, our behavior, our beliefs, our desires, and that is why, which all stem from consciousness. Our consciousness will drive our desires, and our desires will drive our actions. So we need to really, therefore, concentrate on that. So the only way to counteract, the main is to associate, to have someone who can actually, like a guru, who can take us to on the right path, a spiritual master. We have to have, there must be some place where we can turn to, somebody we can turn to, where we are the useless person, where we are nobody. Unless we have that, unless we can come to that platform, we would not be even starting to make progress. So to find a guru becomes very most important, and also to very strongly associate with sadhus. Sadhus means gurus included, but then there are others, especially those in the renounced order. Those who, particularly for grihasthas in the married life, to the degree that they respect the renounced order, to that extent they will develop their humility. To the degree that they don't respect the renounced order, to that degree, then it is just a matter of ego in the business world, ego in the spiritual world. You will be just carrying your own ego from here to there. And why we say? Because when we understand that what we may not be able to do, but when we see people who have given up their lives and surrendered to trying to control their senses and giving everything to live a life of a mendicant and serve the mission of Krishna, then that is the example that would inspire us, and we need to move towards that. So that's why the association of sadhus becomes extremely important for us. And what type of association? It is that consciousness that I am nothing. If we come to associate physically and say that, okay, I need to have a few sadhus in my house, I respect them, but they must come, they must do this. If we order them, if we expect them to do what we want, then that is not association. Even if we don't order them, but if we desire and we maneuver to have them, that this is what they should do, this is what they should do, and because they are very surrendered, and if we try to get what we want, then Krishna sees everything. So our attitude in how we associate with sadhus is also very, very important. In that mood that we are nothing and we are here to serve, how we can please you, how we can learn from you, then we have a chance that our false ego gradually goes down. And as I said, that at least there must be some areas, some places where we can turn to, where we do not have any, where we don't carry our baggage of the past. Because when we are in the material world and we have the risk of being in the mode of passion and carrying on various activities, because we do have to play a role of controllers many times. We do have to play a role of taking decisions or ordering people or doing things, and we may make mistakes, and then we certainly get caught up in the successes also, and we get consumed by the worries. So then we have a serious risk of being influenced by what is best for me. And to counter that, we need to be with people who do not have any worries about that, or do not, and their sole dedication and happiness is how they can please Srila Prabhupada and the acharyas. So, and if we do get that opportunity, it is a miracle, nothing short of a blessing, a miracle that we have actually got this, and it's not something to be taken, taken lightly. The examples of Yudhishthir Maharaj, Dashrath Maharaj, they were ruling the whole world. When we talk now, we don't have that kind of empires. But at that time, when Yudhishthir Maharaj was the emperor of the whole world, and yet when he called the sadhus at home, the way he addressed them and really surrendered himself to them, and then at the same time when they went, he ruled as effectively as anyone else, with fairness, with promptness, with decisiveness, and very clear-headedness. But with that spirit that it is Krishna who is the doer, and I am just his instrument. Same with Dashrath Maharaj, when Vishwamitra Muni would come to his house, palace, and he would offer him. It was not just a token, not to show only, but it was actually with great feeling that this is someone who's worthy of the deepest respect, would completely bow down to him and please him. And Vishwamitra Muni, of course, being a great soul himself, would also test him, and as he did when he asked him for his two sons. And he passed the test. So when he was given that opportunity, he grabbed it. So we see here in this that Krishna, out of his mercy, has intervened in the life of Indra. So this is another example for us that when we see that Indra is, we would say, why is he such a powerful personality, a great demigod and a great devotee? Why is he made a fool like this? But actually, of course, it is to show us that Indra's greatness was in admitting his mistake. And you can imagine the humiliation he would have felt, because he was completely exposed later on when he realized that the so-called foolish boy that he talked of was actually the Supreme Personality, and then he had forgotten his role, and he came down and unequivocally he apologized. So by that we also see the paths that we need to follow. That when we said we are tiny Indras, means we are getting caught up in our own world and we do make mistakes. But then to have the humility to admit the mistakes and to understand that it is Krishna's mercy which is bringing Indra on the right path. So this is Krishna deliberately, purposely, he spoilt the sense gratification of Indra when he intervened here. But then as we see later, that Indra was very grateful for that. And for us, for anybody, actually, the physical pain is less than the pain that our ego gets inflicted. But then the devotee sees these kind of situations as a learning experience. He doesn't see it as a kind of humiliation. For instance, Giriraj Maharaj, when he was a young brahmachari, once he was walking with Srila Prabhupada, and then he was explaining to him how he has been preaching to a very powerful newspaper man. So Prabhupada was very happy and he said, you are a wonderful PR person. You're handling public relations so well. So Giriraj Maharaj felt very elated. Then slowly the talk turned to humility. So Giriraj, as he was known then, he said that, Prabhupada, I feel that I'm not doing anything for Krishna or for the movement, Krishna consciousness movement. So Prabhupada said that that's a good feeling. That means that is coming out of humbleness. So then Giriraj said that, well, but sometimes that feeling turns into maya. So immediately Prabhupada stopped and he abruptly looked at his disciple and he said, what do you mean turns into maya? You're always in maya. It was such a shock to him, such a stunning thing to him, that immediately he just fell on the ground and paid his obeisances. And he remembered this, 33, 34 years later. So, but this was as Indra accepted, of course, there was no fault of Giriraj Maharaj, but he understood this as a lesson. What he saw, immediately in that flash, he says that he saw his relationship with his spiritual master and Prabhupada's role and what his role is. So, we have to see in that whenever we get a lesson, or it's just a lesson, then it's fine, but it could be a reversal also. We can have disappointments, many difficulties. We need to accept it in the right way. Not like Indra, we should not be throwing our thunderbolts to Krishna. Whatever little tiny thunderbolts they may be, or try to retaliate. Because it is futile. Sometimes we see that people, I know one of the most powerful political leaders of India, who happens to be head of a Hindu organization, so-called Hindu organization. And when his wife died, immediately his reaction was that, I don't believe in God. How can he do it? She was such a wonderful soul and so on. Now, this is it is like a childishness, because as she died, he will also die and we all will die. So there was nothing you can do about it. But to try to understand what is death and how it happens, coming from such a high personality, we can see that it is that there is ignorance, not knowledge. So when we get an opportunity to understand what Krishna consciousness is, what our role is, then in that way we have to push ourselves, no matter what the reversals may be. So these reversals could come from material nature, the reversals could come from other devotees, the reversals could come from other living beings, but we should accept it in the right way, not to take it in the wrong way. Once Prabhupada was in Amsterdam in 1972 and there was a temple opening. So this is to show how the devotees would accept humiliation also, because there was a temple opening, so they called Srila Prabhupada, and then there was a TV crew and there were many guests, everyone had come. But they were so inexperienced that they had totally messed up everything. They had not prepared anything. So when Prabhupada came and he found that it was so disorganized, and he was very upset. So even in front of the TV crews and others, he never minced words. He was not trying to have any facade. He just made it very clear. And he expressed his displeasure to them, saying that you are welcoming the deities, you have to have all the preparations done. Why is it not done? Where are the fruits? So they said that we have used it in the fruit salad. So like that, then Prabhupada got even more upset. Then when they found that the altar also was not properly made, the deities, they had called the deities, got the deities, but they didn't fit into the altar. So they had to close the curtains and the guests were waiting and the carpenter was called to raise the height and put the DT. So that kind of thing. So Prabhupada expressed this pleasure. But the devotees were very humble. They accepted that their mistake and they were very, very sorry and they were extremely upset that they upset Prabhupada. So Prabhupada completely forgot about it afterwards and, you know, he clearly showed his deep love for everyone. And the devotees also accepted gratefully and of course, what they did all over the world was amazing. It came, it brought, it showed that their inspiration and their training, everything they brought into the expansion of the Krishna consciousness movement. But when they made a mistake, they were willing to accept it. And then we have a contrasting situation when in the Bombay Pandal, when Prabhupada was addressing 25, 30,000 people every night, one boy just got up and said that, I am God. And he was disturbing the whole thing. And he was telling Prabhupada, kept on saying, I am God. Prabhupada is talking about Krishna as God. And he said, I am God. So Prabhupada shouted back that, no, you are dog. So many people felt offended. And they said, oh, sadhu, why is shouting? Why is staying like getting angry? How he can say he's a dog? So they actually walked out. So we have contrast. It depends on how we see it. If our ego is hurt, if our concept is a very is our own concoction and we think it doesn't fit into that, then we will act accordingly. So we have to see through the eyes of Shastra and act accordingly. We have to see that reversals that may come are also for our good. We have to try to see Krishna in every action that comes and that comes to us. And we should be grateful for that because nothing is happening by accident. The opportunity to come to the temple here, the opportunity to associate with devotees, the opportunity is not, is why is it that out of 15 million people, such so few people get opportunities to actually intermingle and try to get a chance to improve. So that one has to see it in that way and then see how we can really implement it in our own lives. And in that way we can make Krishna conscious progress. Hare Krishna. So are there any questions? Any comments? Mahaprabhuji, you need a mic.
Got a wonderful lecture by your realization, but we would like to know, or I would like to know, what you, because this question was asked to me, and I'm repeating just, I was in Los Angeles, and somebody asked me the question, and I'm asking you, so people should get the advantage, and the question is, what will be your ultimate aim of life?
You're asking what my ultimate aim of life is. I just hope that I can become a sincere devotee. I think that would be, I guess, everybody's goal.
How you, means on that line, how you like to practice, or you are already working on that line, but you may be trying to reach to that to become the pure devotee. So how, what is the line?
I said sincere devotee, I didn't say pure devotee. Well, this is the process of Krishna consciousness, which is a very scientific process and which really starts with Shravanam, Kirtanam, Vishnu Smaranam, as Prahlad Maharaj has said. We start by hearing. That means we understand the philosophy, then we associate with devotees. We have a little faith, then we associate with devotees. Adho Shraddha, Tata Sadhu Sang, Tata Bhajan Kriya, Anant Vritti. Gradually our weaknesses will start diminishing. So it's a scientific process that is given to us, and that process is one which is based on sadhana bhakti, which means we have to do it out of obedience. It is not out of whimsicalness or out of spontaneity. It is out of a discipline. Just like we do anything in life, I mean, for any goal, whether it is to do well in school or whether you do well in business or anything, you have to make efforts. It is no surprise that almost all the successful chief executives or corporations, most of them would be getting up by 5 in the morning. Most of them. And they're in the office before 7. I would say 90% of the, if you take the top 100 companies in the world, 90% would be in the office before 7 o'clock in the morning. 90%. It's no exaggeration. So you can see the amount of discipline they bring in. But that spiritual lethargy is there. So the process is a spiritual process, and we have to decide whether we want to accept it and put that same discipline into this goal. So the process is the same for all, and it is a very practical process, and Srila Prabhupada's greatest contribution has been in ISKCON to give us an association of like-minded people, but also to make it a very practical way of combining it with whatever we're doing. We don't need to give up anything externally. The consciousness that he talks of, Krishna consciousness, is really how we attach Krishna to everything. So that's the process. It's a step-by-step process.
Hare Krishna. Prabhuji, in your lecture, you have been mentioning about the corporate world, like, you know, Infosys or anything of that sort. And today's professionals are simply falling prey for the immediate wage packet they get. But in the bargain, they have been squeezed like a sugar cane. You know, with due respect to them, the corporates, what they pay, because I remember when my father was working with ICI for 42 and a half years, he goes at 9:15 and the office winds up at 5 o'clock and comes back at 5:30 or whatever it is. And today's world, you know, more than 18 hours, these boys and young girls, they work. And they virtually fall prey. Nothing in their head other than their, you know, corporate. Okay, I am working for so-and-so, I am working for so-and-so. So how they can get into spiritual life at all? Because all the time their consciousness is not Krishna consciousness or God consciousness. Infosys consciousness or Wipro consciousness, like that. Now, for these youngsters...
Different
murti, as you rightly mentioned. So my question is, many youngsters are here and they are attending Prerna festival also. So, will you please guide us, you being a very big corporate?
No, therefore, we saw in Queen Kunti's prayers, which is very, very revealing. And when she says that that having these attributes, a lot of wealth, intelligence, good looks, this is actually a high birth. They're actually the major obstacles to spiritual life, if you don't have the right consciousness. But if you have the right consciousness, then they're all coming from Krishna and can be used for Krishna. And actually they are being used. If you see the spread of the ISKCON and other genuine movements, we are seeing that though Prabhupada was the main person, but he couldn't have done it, all these his foot soldiers who were there. So they had brought in whatever their intelligence they had, and their capabilities they brought in, and with the right consciousness they did it. So basically, but in the main part, these are, it makes it more difficult for people when you have these attributes. It's a bigger challenge to accept Krishna consciousness. It's a fact, and therefore one can sympathize with that actually. And it's just therefore we say that when we somehow get a chance out of the causeless mercy, there's no point in trying to fathom out as to where, how it happened. It's not possible. That is, it's always going to remain a mystery. But we get that chance, we should just grab it. That's why Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj said that the first requirement for spiritual life is simplicity. If we simplify our life in every aspect, then Krishna consciousness would be able to make an entry. So we have to, after hearing this, then if we are in such situations, then it will be a challenge, but then at least we can't say that we didn't know. And then having known this, then we have to make every effort, and it is possible. Some of the most brilliant people have been in our acharyas and the parampara, and how is it that they managed? Bhaktivinoda Thakur, you know his life story. It was amazing how he could do it. What he was doing as a district magistrate in the British Times, In 5 minutes, he could handle that many cases which others couldn't do in 1 hour. And he was so valuable to the British that they actually laid, 150 years ago, they laid a single meter gauge track only right up to his house so that they could save time and he could come there. So he was so productive, and he wrote 80 poems and literature. And yet he was the most Krishna conscious and he raised 13 children. So we have so many examples. So for individuals, for those who are in the outside world and who, it's a very, very, it's going to be very difficult. And especially when they have been given this, because the so-called blessing makes it more difficult, it becomes a greater obscurity in their eyes. But if we, through that, if we get an opportunity to meet a devotee and we get a chance to hear, read, and then we have to take it. We should not, we should have the courage to go against the current of what the whole world may be doing. Just because 1,000 people are going in the wrong direction doesn't mean that one person should also follow. This is where we get a chance to use our intelligence and see what is the right way. So we have to see what is, who is intelligent. What is the definition of intelligence? Just like modern education will say that PhD is the very high level. But if you see, when Chaitanya Mahaprabhu asked Ramanand Rai, who is the most educated person? So he said the most educated person, the most learned person is one who understands the science of Krishna consciousness. That's it. Prahlad Maharaj also, when he was asked by Hiranyakashipu that what did you learn? And he was given the best of training, that he said that Shravanam Kirtanam Vishnu Smaranam. And he also concluded, Prahlad Maharaj, that the most scientific process of devotional service is by understanding the art of Krishna consciousness. So when we have, so we have to decide and judge for ourselves using our intelligence. But if we want to just follow what is the general way, and we are brainwashed into thinking that is the only way, then we will also suffer. So we are not against doing a PhD. In fact, as we said, everything comes from Krishna. We can actually admire. So when we see someone, say Indra Nui, you can say she's the new Indra, Nai Indra. And we talked about the old Indra. But actually we can see that it's such capacity. Imagine to be able to work so hard in a difficult world and able to be successful. So it's a great attribute. But the unfortunate part we may say is that with all that, they're using the intelligence to sell colored water, ultimately. 100 hours a week, I mean, putting, and with such intelligence, earning 150 crores a year personally, for what? Either selling colored water or converting potatoes into high value-added products. That's it. Imagine your whole life for that. And getting the whole world in organizing that. So that's the unfortunate part. So we actually admire, I mean, when we see Krishna's splendor in the intelligence, in someone's given the blessed with, you know, very high environment, like a Vaishnava background. So it's a good fortune. So everything comes from Krishna. So intelligence also comes from Krishna. So we can only try to help ourselves, and then through that we can help others. So we have to be watchful. I mean, everybody has to be watchful. And those of us who are in the outside world, mingling with the other aspects of society, we have to be even more watchful than others.
Much.
Okay. We'll take one more question. And Shidam Sakar.
Hare Krishna. Prabhuji, you mentioned about the most important part of spiritual life as respecting sadhus. So since the Radha Gopinath congregation is growing, many of the projects are such that the grihasthas work on an equal level with sadhus in the project. It could be a preaching project like that. And maybe some terms of material considerations, the intelligence shows that, okay, this particular decision that is being taken by a brahmachari, your colleague brahmachari, is not proper. So what do a grihastha preacher do in that case? He should just accept a lower position and let, you know, everything in the hands of Krishna, or he should...
No, when we say respecting the renounced order, it is much more deep than that. When we are doing a service, and that is the specific aspect of And we have to then consider what is the best way we can do it. So if someone is making a mistake, that is, it's not that the other person has a fall down. You know, it's a technicality, it's a functional issue. So we, in a humble way, we can always correct it. It doesn't mean that by correcting it, we have become superior and we are disrespecting that. That is not the understanding. The understanding is, when we respect the dinosaur, it means we actually really deeply try to imbibe those qualities that which we cannot have or we do not have, and that someone who is completely surrendered or attempting to give be totally away from all kinds of prestige, recognition, etc. So we try to follow that. Now in that, when we get a chance to act together in one particular service, then we should try to do what is best for that service. So if someone is making some mistake there, there is no harm in saying that this is the way we could do it, if we are in a position to do it, because we have been given that background. So it is not a sign of disrespect at all. Neither would that person feel, nor we should feel. And neither should we feel that, well, we know something more than others. In fact, then that means we are not understanding the message. So we are just doing it because we have, somebody has a particular skill, some attribute. So we use that. We are talking of the spiritual characteristics and the things which which we try to respect, that when to bring in that kind of self-discipline, to completely follow the process blissfully, to not worry about all the time about material assets, etc. No, when we have taken a responsibility in Grihastha, we should do it well. So it's not that we should abandon it and then keep on feeling that I wish I was like that. That is not the way. But we discharge it in a spirit, knowing that Krishna is the doer and controller, and at the same time we do what is best, but then by associating with sadhus, we will temper our ambition. We will not then just go whole hog into in such a way that we will jeopardize our spiritual life. And that's why the association of sadhus becomes vital for us. And that association is not only physical. Association is, we may not necessarily meet them also regularly, or we may not be in the same city also. But if we are really, if that is our, these are the heroes, then we try to do, to know more about it and to actually follow it. And then to ask them on and off when we can do that. And sadhus also would include the acharyas, the gurus, you know, our guru, other senior Prabhupada disciples, certainly, whenever we get a chance, those who are, you know, very active and mobile. Did I end here? Granthraj, Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai, Srila Prabhupada ki jai.